From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the Bush administration asserted on the record that Iran was behind a new especially lethal explosive device that's been killing American soldiers in Iraq. And this week, the media responded in a variety of ways. Here's NBC's David Gregory at the president's Tuesday press conference.
Critics say that you are using the same quality of intelligence about Iran that you used to make the case for war in Iraq, specifically about WMD, that turned out to be wrong, and that you are doing that to make a case for war against Iran. Is that the case?
I can say with certainty that the Quds Force, a part of the Iranian government, has provided these sophisticated IEDs that have harmed our troops.
Many media critics were experiencing an eerie sense of deja vu, especially regarding the first story on the alleged Iranian devices published in last Saturday's New York Times. That story, by Michael Gordon, made heavy use of unnamed government sources asserting the Iranian connection. In fact, it seemed to resemble a story written by Gordon and Judith Miller in 2002, which helped make the government's case for war in Iraq. That story quoted unnamed officials claiming that Saddam was acquiring aluminum tubes for use in nuclear weapons production. That story was wrong. Michael Massing has been a strong critic of the media's pre-war coverage, and he was stunned by the February 10th story in The Times.
Yeah, I would put it that I was floored by seeing this. The Times, you know, issued a mea culpa about its earlier stories in which they seemed overly credulous. And I really think the Times has been doing a much better job guarding against falling into that same trap. And lo and behold, February 10th, in the same column of the newspaper, the same slot as the earlier Gordon Miller story, we have another story smelling very similarly as having been planted by the U.S. government and very much promoting its bellicose intentions toward a nation in the Middle East. As well, it had very few qualifiers like the earlier story. It talked about civilian and military officials from a broad range of government agencies providing specific details to support their case. I read the whole thing looking for those qualifiers, that this sounds very similar to what the administration has done in the past, looking at least for outside experts to evaluate the nature of this, and there was virtually nothing.
Now, that story ran, I believe, on a Saturday. On Monday came a story by James Glantz that emerged from a press conference held in Iraq with senior military officials, anonymous senior military officials, who went on in much greater detail about these armaments and their provenance, tracking serial numbers back to Iran and so forth. Now, that story may be suspicious as well, but not for want of being skeptical. It seemed to me that it was, you know, something close to a minuet dancing around the facts presented by the government, calling attention to the holes in the government's analysis and the fact that nobody in the military would go on the record.
Yes, it was interesting. The story about the press conference seemed to be a sign that the Times realized that it was hanging out there in a similar way that it had been earlier and that it had resolved to avoid again. And so you just found many more caveats and qualifiers in that story. And I think the press corps in general, the way they reported that press conference, has brought a fair amount of skepticism to it. So I think that the Baghdad press corps was responding in a way different from this Times reporter in Washington was, where he was just getting this information directly from government sources. So I was glad to see the second story, and then subsequently also the Times on its editorial page asking good questions, and in a follow-up story yet again on Tuesday raising even more questions about sort of what the administration is up to. It's not merely the sort of question of whether or not these weapons originated in Iran and how much the Iranian government was involved, but it's the whole nature of what the administration is trying to accomplish here. That is the real sort of story, I think. Why now? Why are they pushing so hard? Looking at this weapons presentation in the context of all the other things that the United States is doing vis-a-vis Iran, those are the really important questions that need to be asked. And I'm encouraged to see that many news organizations, including The Times, are asking them.
All right, Michael. Thank you so much.
Okay, Bob. Thanks. I appreciate it.
Michael Massing is a contributing editor at the Columbia Journalism Review. He wrote, "Now they tell us, the American press in Iraq."
Massing isn't the only one sniffing parallels between Saddam's alleged aluminum tubes and Iran's explosively formed penetrators, or EFPs. Washington Post columnist Dan Frumkin asked, quote, "Is the Bush administration once again building a faulty case for war? And is the press going along for the ride?" We asked New York Times reporter Michael Gordon. He says there's a big difference between the aluminum tubes story and the one on Iranian EFPs.
First off, on the tubes, the New York Times and I myself learned from that experience. I wish I had been a bit more skeptical on the tubes issue when it first came along. And my view at the time was, well, they've got the tubes in their possession. It didn't come from a defector. It didn't come from Chalabi. It wasn't based on a photo. And it took me a while, although it was before the war, but it still took me a while to figure out that there was significant dissent within the intelligence community. In this case, we ran those traps prior to publishing this story. We held up the story, and we tried to satisfy ourselves that we weren't overlooking a counter-argument within the intelligence community that this material didn't come from Iran.
But one of the frustrating similarities for many people is the reliance on, quote, civilian and military officials from a broad range of government agencies. Now, according to the New York Times policy, and I'm quoting here, when we use such anonymous sources, we accept an obligation not only to convince the reader of their reliability, but also to convey what we can learn of their motivation. Well, I read through your piece carefully. I couldn't find any explanation of why your sources required that they would be unnamed.
Let me explain to you how I went about doing this story. I was embedded in Baghdad on a patrol in Al Anbar in July that was hit by an IED. One Iraqi soldier was killed and several wounded, and I wrote a story about that. And so when I was in Baghdad in October, I heard from the troops with whom I was embedded that there was a particularly lethal form of IED, and I set out to do a story not really about the Iranian connection, but about these devices. And as I explored this over a period of weeks, I gained access and quoted verbatim in the New York Times some of the intelligence that was done by the American experts who work on such things. And it said that key devices for these systems were being supplied by Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard, Quds Force, kind of paramilitary force. That's really what I reported. What I did not assert is that it was being done at the highest levels of the Iranian government. That was asserted by military briefers who conducted a session in Baghdad subsequent to my article.
And in fact, the subsequent reporting offered some dissenting voices and some notes of skepticism. But that initial piece didn't have any. And the lack of direct attribution together with the timing led many critics to conclude that your piece could have been the product of calculated government leaks.
To me, it's pretty interesting because if you look back at my own coverage over the last several months, I broke the Hadley story memo in which the National Security Advisor in the United States expressed really the gravest of concerns about the kind of reliability of the Maliki government, whether it was really a credible partner in Iraq. I broke the Rumsfeld memo in which we learned that the Secretary of Defense had privately favored many of the proposals being advanced by Democratic lawmakers today. I'm used to getting a lot of criticism from the right. Now there's this criticism from the left that somehow this was an orchestrated story. And in fact, these assertions about Iran have a long history. General Casey has made these assertions. More recently, Robert Gates. Early in the year, Negroponte. General Abizaid has alluded to the Iranian connection. So there have been a whole slew of on-the-record statements. The problem is when you try to get into the physical evidence, the specific data that is drawn on by the intelligence community, you end up talking to people who don't really like to be identified. And that was the situation that I was in.
I understand that many administration officials have gone on the record pointing the finger at Iran. On the other hand, we've all had a belly full of administration officials shoveling crap into the media and onto the American public? And does it concern you at all, even though I know it's not your job to be concerned about these things, that given how Vice President Cheney touted your stories before the war, at least the one about the tubes, that the White House might again point to the Times to justify a further escalation in the region?
See, I'm puzzled by the notion that military intelligence gathered from the battlefield about a particular type of IED, its properties, and the source of origin necessarily implies that we have to adopt one policy toward Iran or another.
You don't think that that implication is there?
See, I think you can accept the analysis that these devices, and I don't know anyone who's challenged it, come from Iran, and you could still take the view that the United States should talk to Tehran. You could make that argument, or you could make the kind of argument some in the Bush administration make, that this explains why they've conducted raids against Iranian operatives in Iraq over the past couple of months. I think you need to separate the politics from the intelligence.
It's very difficult to do that because we have a history where they have been inseparable. It really doesn't matter what kind of informed, reasonable debates you could have outside the White House.
Well, we're trying to have an informed, reasonable debate. And the way I look at this is this intelligence and information work doesn't come from the top down. It doesn't come from the White House. It comes from the bottom up. In the case of WMD, the United States was really flying blind. The CIA didn't have many good human intelligence operatives in Iraq. It was essentially extrapolating from old information. We were on the outside looking in. In the case of Iraq, we're in. For better or for worse, we're in. And these weapons are being used against American troops. And every time a Humvee is blown up by some of these systems, intelligence experts pick up the pieces, gather them, analyze it, do a kind of forensic analysis, combine that with signals intelligence, information about smuggling rings, and the kind of characters one finds in Iraq. And they've produced this picture. This is a picture produced on the battlefield in Iraq, not produced in the White House.
Michael, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Michael Gordon is chief military correspondent for the New York Times.
Coming up, a journalist breaks the record for jail time.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Hello, I'm John Hodgman, expert and author of The Areas of My Expertise. Did you know I also work for National Public Radio's On the Media? Well, it's pledge time again, and I know you're wondering what we do with your money. Here at On the Media, we find many productive ways to spend those hard-earned donations. For example, I bought myself a new scarf, kind of greenish with streaks of yellow, and boy, has it really come in handy this winter. Also, I had my laptop enlarged so I can listen to the On the Media podcast. And have I told you about the sunsets on the Costa del Sol? Unforgettable, especially when viewed from the deck of my small yacht, the SS Cokie Roberts. So from everyone here at On the Media, from National Public Radio, thank you for your pledge.
Wait a minute. I'm Brooke Gladstone. I work at On the Media, and I have never been to the Costa del Sol. But I feel like I've been to Cambodia, Pakistan, Rome, Lebanon, Afghanistan, and even Albania, thanks to the reporters who have covered the media there for us. You have a direct connection to their good work because your pledge helps pay for those reporters and for the podcasts, too. Our listeners increasingly rely on podcasts, and your contributions help keep them coming every week. Now, John.
What? What is it?
Time for a correction. You don't really work it on the media, do you?
Who are you again? I've never seen you around here. But I have to go right away.
But you don't have to work it on the media to make a difference. Just go to WNYC.org and make a pledge and tell them the podcast matters to you. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. We're about to go where many American news organizations prefer not to go, knowing full well that doing so amounts to an invitation for angry mail from all sides. I speak, of course, of the conflict in the Middle East, and specifically the debate over Israel's policies in the occupied territories, or rather, the debate about that debate, as in, how free are Americans to publicly criticize Israel?
Last year, two prominent academics, John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt, published a paper accusing the pro-Israel lobby of hijacking American foreign policy and trying to silence its media critics. The response came fast and furious with charges of anti-Semitism. The uproar had barely subsided last fall when Jimmy Carter released his book, provocatively titled Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. More controversy, more charges of anti-Semitism. Last month, the influential American Jewish Committee hit back with an essay by Indiana University professor Alvin Rosenfeld. It was called Progressive Jewish Thought and the New Anti-Semitism, and it charged that liberal American Jews, from playwright Tony Kushner to Washington Post columnist Richard Cohen, were aiding and abetting Israel's enemies. Was that proof that powerful Jewish groups were squelching debate? We asked J.J. Goldberg, the editor of the liberal Jewish daily The Forward, what he thought about Rosenfeld's essay.
He maintains the position that progressive is tantamount to anti-Israel and anti-Jewish. There are vast numbers, probably more Jews who call themselves progressive or liberal, who are pro-Israel, pro-Jewish, who are generals in the Israeli army, who are progressive. But there's not a hint of recognition of that in the booklet, so that if you read it, you have to assume that when somebody says, I'm a progressive Jew, you have to watch out for an anti-Semite. And that verges, in my mind, on slander.
So the article starts with a discussion of historic anti-Semitism, mentioning things like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and new Arabic translations of Mein Kampf. And then it goes on to basically equate criticism of Israeli policies in the Palestinian territories with that kind of anti-Semitism.
Well, there are people out there who are saying, I would say with increasing vigor, that Israeli policies in the West Bank toward the Palestinians are an inherent outgrowth of the nature of a Zionist state, and therefore Israel shouldn't exist. Now, for many activists in the Jewish community, the notion that Israel shouldn't exist is tantamount to the notion that the Jews, alone among all the world's peoples, aren't allowed to have a state, that they've been singled out. And so it becomes a vision of anti-Semitism. Now, what he's got is a collection of Jews who say that creating Israel was a mistake. Then he's got people who say one could reach that conclusion the way things are going. Then he's got people who say it may not have been a smart idea, although now it is a reality. And then he's got people who say, sometimes I feel like this, I'm so frustrated. So it reaches from Israel is evil and Jews are evil down a slippery slope to I got up this morning and I was just fed up.
Now, there have been arguments about Israel within the Jewish community forever, pretty much. But do you think that the debate has recently intensified?
The debate has certainly intensified. The conflict, the longer it goes on, and the more violent it becomes, and the more intractable it seems, the less sympathy there is for Israel. There's a sense in other countries, and increasingly in the intellectual class in this country, that the world has reached an incendiary state that has, as at least part of its core, this conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, and it's making people angry and frustrated. In my mind, the best way to stop that alarming growth of hostility toward Israel and its allies, namely us Jews, is to try and resolve the conflict, rather than try and stop people from feeling the way they feel. There's an old Groucho Marx line in one of his movies where he looks at somebody and says, who are you going to believe, me or your own two eyes? At a certain point, people are really, really, really angry, and you have to start saying, well, what's making them so angry?
One of the prime examples that people point to when they say that organized Jewish groups are squelching debate in this country is the recent example of New York University historian Tony Judt, who wrote an article in 2003 that has been highly criticized by Jewish groups. He was scheduled to speak at the Polish consulate.
In fact, he was scheduled to be a lecturer at a group that rents space from the Polish Cultural Center in New York once a month. It was publicized in a local newspaper. Two Jewish organizations called up to find out what it was about. The first was the Anti-Defamation League. An official from the ADL called up, found out it was a rented space, and hung up, and that was the end of it. The American Jewish Committee went a step further. Their executive director called and said, "Do you know what the likely reaction would be if you go ahead with this program?" The consul said, "No, I don't know." He said, "Well, there would probably be anger." And in fact, there would. There would be picket lines. At which point, the ambassador Googled Tony Judt and found out how much he's disliked among activist Jews and decided to cancel the program. Was it a threat or was it friendly advice that the streets are going to erupt? Probably the latter. It was taken as a threat. And the worst part is that the Anti-Defamation League, which is the better known of the two organizations, became the whipping boy for something that it was only tangentially involved in.
So let's talk about the Jimmy Carter book, in which in the title comes the word apartheid. Do you think that the anger generated by this book is a question of people overly hung up on the title?
The title does, to a degree, reflect the book. The book takes the Israel-Palestine conflict and lays it out as though it were entirely Israel's fault, as though Israel had the opportunity at every stage going back 38 years to choose the path of peace and rejected it. And the implication in the title, Peace or Apartheid, is it did that because there is a belief system which sees Jews as somehow superior to Arabs. That is deeply offensive to the vast majority of Jews. It doesn't reflect, I think, the fundamental truths of the situation. It's as unfair as Alvin Rosenfeld's use of the word progressives and anti-Semitism to draw a parallel that really doesn't exist. They're both highly inflammatory titles.
And yet, last month in your own newspaper, you published an opinion piece about the Carter book by Yossi Beilin, a member of Israel's Knesset, and he basically said that while he disagreed with the term apartheid, he'd heard this argument all before within Israel. Would you say that it's simply easier to level criticisms at the Israeli state in Israel than it is here?
There's certainly truth in that. I'd also add that it's easier to level criticisms at Israel in Israel than at the Palestinians among Palestinians, so that you hear a more nuanced debate among the Israelis than you do among the Palestinians, which would create the impression that the Israelis have more to regret than the Palestinians do, because you don't hear the expressions of regret on the Palestinian side. Now, in Israel, because they're living in this situation, it's their lives on the line, it's their children getting blown up and shot, they need to find a way out of this mess. So there is going to be a readiness to consider all kinds of possibilities.
And is that why you think that there are discussions taking place in the Israeli press that we simply don't see here in the American media?
We're hearing it right now on this program. We're hearing it on this program because Jimmy Carter published a book, because various professors have published papers. There is a very lively discussion in the American media. There is a tendency among American Jews and among American allies of Israel to view open discussion of Israel's faults as a threat to Israel's existence. Because of that tendency, people are afraid. When your switchboard lights up with 500 angry phone calls, you're going to think twice. If you're a congressman and you get 15 or 20 angry letters, or somebody organizing fundraising for your opponent, no matter who it is, because you've offended them, you will think twice.
These perceptions you have about how the debate has transpired in this country come from the editor of a left-leaning newspaper that would probably be tarred as progressive in the worst possible way by some of the groups that we're discussing. And yet you feel that it's wrong to say that they have successfully squelched the discussion in this country, that actually they may have tried, but they haven't done it.
I would say the amount we hear of complaint about the squelching is proof that there isn't squelching.
JJ, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke. It's a pleasure to be here.
JJ Goldberg is editor-in-chief of the Jewish Daily Forward in New York City.
An unfortunate record was set last week when Josh Wolf became the journalist to spend the longest amount of time in an American prison for refusing to hand materials over to prosecutors. Lawyer Martin Garbus is representing Josh Wolf, and he joins me now. Martin, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
6 months is a long time to spend in jail. What exactly did Josh Wolf do to get himself there?
He was taking video pictures at a demonstration in September 2005. It was a demonstration against G8, a meeting which was then going on in Europe. At the demonstration, there were two fights, and allegedly a police car was damaged. After he took the videos, a local station wanted some of it from him. He gave some of it to the local station. Some of it he put up on his website. There's a chunk that he didn't put up on the website and didn't give to the local station. That's what the federal government wants. And they want not only the video, but they want him to testify in a grand jury as to who are the people in the video and who are the other people at the demonstration. Now, the subpoena is not the normal subpoena that comes out of the California federal court. It's a subpoena signed by the Joint Terrorism Task Force, which operates out of Washington.
And Wolf has refused to turn this material over. For what reason?
He believes that he's a journalist, and as a journalist, he should not be compelled to become an arm of the state. Now, the video has nothing on it that relates either to the two beatings or to the cop car. And we've told that to the judge in court, and we have told the judge that he can look at the video, and he will determine that it has nothing to do with the subpoenaed material. But what they're trying to do is to get a reporter to describe who was at a demonstration. Many of the people at the demonstration were masked. A lot of the people spoke to him, and they took their masks off. And so far as I know, they're not on any other video. Now, is there a signed confidentiality agreement? Absolutely not. Did these people assume that if the FBI or the Joint Terrorism Task Force sought a video from Josh Wolf, that he would turn it over? Absolutely not.
Now, this would not have happened if he had been in state court, because California has a shield law that explicitly protects reporters from exactly this kind of inquiry. So how did it wind up in federal court to begin with?
Well, their claim is that it's in federal court because federal government property was damaged, i.e. a taillight to a police car. Clearly, the beatings, the two fightings, are in the state court. And also, traditionally, if you have damage to a car and you have other prosecutions in the state court, you would have it all in the state court. So if they're really doing it, I think, and since it's coming from the Joint Terrorism Task Force, is this is a way of getting information similar to databases and NSA surveillance about the Bush enemies or people who were opposed to Iraq. There were those kinds of signs as well as anti-G8 signs. And the ACLU has joined us and submitted a brief arguing precisely that.
You've just written a book about the Supreme Court with the Bush appointees. I gather you think that the Josh Wolf case bodes ominously for the kind of decisions that this court will be handing down.
Yes, I think the Roberts Alito Supreme Court will even further narrow the rights that journalists have. When they do the balancing as to whether or not you should strip a privilege because of the weight of the crime, I think they're going to balance it very, very badly against journalists. I think also when it comes to putting somebody in jail, they're going to view very badly towards journalists. Thirdly, the whole question of a blogger. I think they will not at this time find bloggers, internet people, etc., who are journalists, to be journalists. And fourthly, I think they'll find that if you have a political bias, then that makes you lose your journalist privilege. They won't with someone from the New York Times or the San Francisco Chronicle, but they'll find it with somebody like Josh, who's only a blogger.
Martin Garbus is representing Josh Wolf. Garbus's new book is titled The Next 25 Years, The New Supreme Court, and What It Means for Americans. Martin, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
LBJ took the IRT down to 4th Street.
The world is in a hurry. That's probably why the world's best-known word is an acronym. It began life in 1839 as a joke penned by an editor at the Boston Morning Post, a conscious misspelling of the phrase all correct, a.k.a. OK. Did I say a.k.a.? Did you notice? Americans are in such a hurry, we use lots of acronyms. PTA, SUV, CPR, NFL, NATO, NASA, NAFTA, NASDAQ. Actually, the first four are initialisms, since you can't really pronounce them as words, but we call them acronyms anyway. We've used some of them so long, we've forgotten what they stand for. SCUBA, LASER, TNT. But some we'll always remember, like POSLQ. Person of the opposite sex sharing living quarters, spawned by the U.S. Census. The census, of course, is based in Washington, where being in a hurry is a matter of national security. So the Capitol is littered with acronyms. The President of the United States is POTUS. The Supreme Court is SCOTUS. The State of the Union is SOTU. And the U.S. Patriot Act is the Uniting and Strengthening America by Providing Appropriate Tools Required to Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism Act. Take special note of that last one. It shows the public relations punch of a good acronym. Just ask the mothers of MAD, the people of PUSH, or the Caring Committee on American Relief in Europe. But PR is a relatively recent factor in acronym creation. The key components are urgency and bureaucracy and lots of arcane nomenclature. The mother of all acronym generators resides near the Capitol, a five-sided super collider that produces a steady explosion of letters, a veritable alphabet soup. No matter how many snafus the Pentagon encounters, it never goes AWOL. From MRE to RPG to IED to WMD, it specializes in unadorned initials for harsh realities. But these days, PR is another weapon of war, and the civilian phrasemakers seem to be lacking reliable intelligence. Otherwise, why would they allow or even perhaps help craft the name of the new security crackdown in Iraq launched this week by Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki? He calls it Operation Imposing Law. Here's hoping they don't abbreviate.
Coming up, the LA Times blogs murder, and a reporter digs into some cold cases on civil rights.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last Halloween, three white women were surrounded by a mob of black teenagers in Long Beach, California, and amid a barrage of racial epithets, viciously beaten. The attack was prosecuted as a hate crime. Yet until guilty verdicts were delivered recently, the episode received spotty regional coverage and merited barely a mention even from the sensation-hungry universe of cable news. Examining the coverage recently in the LA Weekly, reporter Kate Coe concluded that the media were paralyzed by racial politics. She joins me now. Kate, welcome to OTM.
Oh, thank you, Bob.
You say that the case was undercovered. How do you measure? What's your standard?
Well, for example, look at the Duke rape case. In writing in Slate, Jack Schaefer had complained that the New York Times had done 20 stories in the first month. It ran a story before there was even an arrest. This, the Long Beach Press-Telegram covered it. The local CBS affiliate did a quick story. The LA Times covered it finally with a story on November 7th. And interestingly enough, no national electronic media picked it up until News and Notes on NPR covered it on November 29th. There was no national television coverage, partially because it's a story with minors who you can't show, and the victims had not wanted to show themselves at that time. But nobody worked very hard at finding a way to do this story either.
You mentioned the LA Times. It was the focus of your piece in the LA Weekly. You said not only did they undercover the story at least early, but they kept changing the reporters assigned to it, which you believe is evidence that it was a low priority for them. Do you, apart from your own suspicions, you know, have any evidence yourself that they deemed this low priority?
The LA Times would not go on the record for my story outside of one email from Doug Franz, the managing editor. And I did speak with Joe Mazingo, the reporter who ended up covering the majority of the case at the trial and informally, but he would never go on the record. Most of the time with a big newspaper like the LA Times, if it's a great story, one reporter is going to want to carve out his or her territory, and they're going to cover it. That the Times shuffled it around to ultimately six different bylines before Mazingo got the case.
What do you believe is at the root of this? Why would this big sensational case not receive, you know, banner coverage in the local regional daily?
I've had people say to me, unfortunately off the record, that if the Times had more black people in their newsroom, they might have covered it in different ways.
What does the race of the reporter have to do with it?
Maybe the reporter doesn't need to be black, but they should be comfortable with asking different types of questions in that sort of urban teenage world environment. One of the defendant's uncles, a guy named Carl Rowe, was at court every day and was handing out a self-published pamphlet where he was explaining the root of this whole problem was that the white women hadn't understood what the black guys were saying to them, and that, in fact, it was taunting back and forth, and it was sort of sexual, but it wasn't intended to be racist. The Press-Telegram, within, I think, the bounds of whatever their stated editorial policy is, was able to let the reader know exactly what was said to these women, whereas the LA Times kept brushing it over. The LA Times, early on, pretty much accepted what the defendant's lawyers said, that these were good kids, scholars, never had a problem. They were all athletes. As is coming out in the reporting now, after the verdicts and after the sentencing, most of these kids had been in trouble before. They had been suspended. They had prior brushes with school authorities for violence. Most of them had very chaotic home lives, which was completely different than the picture that the Times had painted of good working class parents. Their kids had never been in trouble. And nobody ever questioned that.
Can you divine from the coverage or undercoverage of this story something larger about how the media covered any story that so explicitly concerns race?
I think for too long, the media in America has been very comfortable when they have to cover black people as victims. That's something they know about. That's something that's it's easy. They aren't going to get angry letters, angry emails, angry phone calls from people for daring to suggest otherwise. It's very hard to have to look at the actions of individuals as individuals, and it's very easy to lump people in a group. But as long as media insists on covering people in a way that they're comfortable with, I don't think we're necessarily going to get real stories on this.
Kate, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
Kate Coe wrote about the Halloween attacks for the LA Weekly. She also blogs for MediaBistro.com.
In Los Angeles, there are nearly 1,100 homicides annually, but the LA Times covers only about 9% of them. Some murders are covered, one might argue, excessively, others hardly at all. LA Times crime reporter Jill Leoby believes that no victim's story should go untold, but news holes are shrinking. So Leoby has launched the LA Times' new homicide report online, where she'll take note of every death.
There's sort of an upside-down logic of press coverage and homicide where the nature of news is to cover the man-bites-dog story, and what you end up doing is you cover the statistical fringe of homicide. You cover the very unlikely cases that don't represent what's really happening most days in Los Angeles County. it creates, I think, a false view of who's safe and who's not and where homicide is concentrated. And the Times wanted to give an accurate view of what homicide looks like, both from afar and close up.
You know, in the late 80s and 90s, when inner city homicides were at an all-time high, critics of local crime coverage decried the identifying of perpetrators and even victims by race. But you make a point of doing that in the homicide report. In fact, one reader wrote into your blog saying, "Your relentless effort to catalog the victims by race adds to their dehumanization." But you don't agree with that.
It's not that I necessarily disagree. I do record the race of all the homicide victims that are listed on the site, as well as their age and gender and where the homicides occurred and how they died, if I can. With the race question, I suppose, if homicide were equally distributed among Americans, you could argue that it's irrelevant and we should be colorblind in the way that we talk about it. But the fact is that this is an area where there is stunning inequality. Black males in this country are 4% of the population, and they're around 35% of all homicide victims. It's a public health problem, and no more than it would be responsible to talk about AIDS without ever mentioning gay men or intravenous drug users. I think it would be irresponsible to talk about homicide and not talk about the groups that are disproportionately afflicted.
Is there a sense among the families of Black and Latino victims that their stories are undercovered, that there's disproportionate attention paid to, say, the attractive white woman who's murdered in her home?
Oh, that's a chorus. It's a point of view that dominates in my experience covering homicide over the last 6 years. It's interesting that the question about race and talking bluntly about the disproportionate effect of homicide, particularly on Blacks, I find to be more controversial in contexts where people aren't experiencing a lot of homicide. In areas, Compton, Watts, South Central Los Angeles, you generally hear the reverse. You generally hear people say, talk more about this. It needs to be out there more. Why aren't people talking about our victims? You know, it's hard approaching people in moments of extreme grief. As a reporter, it's a very intrusive thing. And occasionally you encounter hostility, but much, much more common is actually kind of a heart-wrenching desperation. I have people actually say to me, you know, tell people this happened.
When you watch the cable news and you see, a Lacey Peterson type story start to unfold hour after hour, wall to wall coverage, do you want to just beat your head against the wall sometimes and say, this is not what crime in America really fundamentally is about?
I do. I mean, I have to say, I was actually doing an immersion project with the Watts Homicide Unit at the time that Scott Peterson was in trial. It was really, they had around 70 murders that year, just running on homicides all the time. And in the morning in the unit, we would drink coffee and talk about what was new with the Lacey Peterson case and then move on to dozens of other homicides. And it was a little bit surreal. That part of it is the hardest. Dealing with families, all of that is difficult in its own way, but that frustration is the hardest part of it.
Sometimes it's been observed that crime reporters are a good place for the cub reporter to begin. It's not a high prestige beat at many big city newspapers. After 6 years on the job, you've probably been offered promotions or what would be regarded as promotions within the newsroom. Would you take them?
Right now I'm very happy being a crime reporter. It's something that I came to a little later in my career, and I find it to be, of all the beats I've covered, that this is the big one. This is really what makes or breaks you. To write about violence in a way that's truthful is absolutely to be up against it. In fact, at homicide scenes, people will always say this. They'll say, I don't have words to describe this. I can't put it into words. And there is something so silencing about trauma and violence. It's almost as if part of the nature of it is to obliterate words and language and make it impossible to convey. You know, my job as a journalist is to witness and to make seen something that I think isn't seen. And to do that, you really have to get immediate. You have to follow the pain. That's the number one rule of homicide reporting. You go for that. You chronicle people's pain. You talk about what this is like.
Jill, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Jill Leovi is a crime reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Her blog is called The Homicide Report.
On February 7th, the Unsolved Civil Rights Crime Act was reintroduced in Congress. It would create a civil rights cold case unit within the Justice Department and the FBI to investigate dozens and dozens of murders, many unreported and untried. For decades, there hasn't even been a comprehensive list of who these victims were. What little attention they have gotten has come not from law enforcement, but from journalists like Jerry Mitchell, a reporter for the Clarion Ledger in Jackson, Mississippi. For nearly 20 years, Mitchell has parlayed his crime reporting skills into murder convictions. It began by accident when he found previously sealed documents from Mississippi's so-called State Sovereignty Commission, a secret segregationist spy agency run by Mississippi's governor. The commission had sabotaged the murder trial of the man accused of killing black activist Medgar Evers and infiltrated civil rights organizations. Mitchell was stunned by his discovery.
They stole documents. They did all this skullduggery. And it just made me curious and want me to get all the rest of the records, which I eventually did. So I did those stories about the Evers case, and eventually the district attorney's office reopened the case. And then that led, in December of 1990, to the arrest of Byron D. LeBeckwith for the killing of Medgar Evers.
Tell me about some of the other cases.
The main one I'd written about was a man named Vernon Damer. His family was literally attacked in the middle of the night by the Klan, firebombs thrown into the house. And he grabbed his shotgun, ran to the front of the house to fire back so his family could escape out the back window. But the fire seared his lungs, and so he died later that day. Several weeks after, in the mail came his voter registration card. He had fought his whole life for the right to vote and never gotten a chance to vote himself. The man who ordered his killing was Imperial Wizard Sam Bowers, the head of the Klan in Mississippi. He had been tried in the 60s, but had never been convicted in that case. And then this guy came forward, and he called me and said he had overheard conversation in which Bowers had given the orders to kill Vernon Damer. So that case was reopened, and Bowers was convicted in August of 1998. Bobby Cherry was the suspect in the Birmingham church bombing that killed four girls back in 1963. I took him and his wife out for barbecue, you know, because, well, I guess that's what you take Klansmen out for. He said, "I didn't have anything to do with that church bombing. I left that sign shop at 9:45 because I had to get home and watch wrestling." So I got back to the newspaper, talked to our librarian, Susan Garcia, and I said, "Susan, just check with the Birmingham News and see what was on TV that night." The next morning, I got an electronic message from Susan, all in capital letters. There was no wrestling. There hadn't been wrestling on for years.
You spoke to him at some length, and in fact, many of the men who have since gone to trial and been successfully prosecuted actually granted you long interviews. How did you get these men in your confidence?
I guess my philosophy has always been that everyone has a desire to tell their story, even old Klansmen. And so I try to approach them from that perspective. And I don't come on that strong. Like Beckwith, Byron D. LeBeckwith, when I sat down and talked with him, well, he had all these questions he asked before he would even talk to me, like, "Are you white? Where do you go to church? Where did you grow up?" But I knew every answer I gave him he would love. I mean, you know, I didn't make up anything. I just told the truth. And sure enough, there I was sitting down and talking to him. I know when Edgar Ray Killen, who was prosecuted in the Mississippi burning case, the killings of Goodman, Schorner, and Cheney, when I took him and his wife out for catfish, at some point he said, "There's some guy in Jackson just keeps stirring things up and stirring things up." I just didn't have the heart to tell him it was me.
I think it's fair to say that you don't have to go too far back in history when the Clarion Ledger was not exactly a beacon of truth, especially on civil rights issues.
Well, I mean, the Clarion Ledger had a lot to atone for. Up until 1968, the Sovereignty Commission was sending its reports directly to the Clarion Ledger and its sister paper, the Jackson Daily News. And the newspapers, in some cases, were printing those stories verbatim.
How about other Southern papers? Were there any that demonstrated, you know, a minimum of a racist bias?
You had papers like the Delta Democrat Times up in Greenville. Hazel Brannon Smith, who is quite a courageous woman, ran her paper in Lexington, Mississippi, and Bill Miner covered a lot of these stories for the Times-Picayune. There were a handful that were actually reporting the truth out there that I basically relied on to try to piece these things together.
There are many unsolved cases of civil rights murders for which there is no paper trail. Are you finding yourself stymied in some of these other cold cases?
The vast majority will never be prosecuted because, you know, when they didn't investigate them at the time, it just makes it doubly difficult to go back and try to investigate them now. A lot of the witnesses have died in these cases. Suspects have died. You know, there's not that much time left. The clock is definitely ticking now.
All right, Jerry. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jerry Mitchell is an investigative reporter for the Clarion Ledger in Jackson, Mississippi. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Vuolo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Peter Garner. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. And you can also subscribe to the newsletter at that address. You can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.